Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to a day of sitting. My name's Kokyo, for those I haven't met. And today we could take a look at this old Zen poem from Tang Dynasty, China. 8th century, one of our lineage ancestors, Shuto Xixian. Hard to say these Chinese names. In Japanese, Sekito Kisen, Daisho. He's the Dharma grandson of the sixth ancestor. When the different lineages of Chinese Zen started to branch out, he's the branch that became our Soto lineage. And he wrote some very early Zen poems. He wrote The Harmony of Difference and Equality. Some of you might know that's chanted regularly in Soto Zen temples. And a short kind of poem on that harmony. And he also wrote this other short poem called Song of the Thatched Hermitage, the Thatched Hut, that we can look at today, if you like. Y'all know thatch? It's like all over the world, in the old days and still in the present day, sometimes they make particularly roofs out of thatch, like. So in Asia and China in the day, I think it was like rice straw. Once they take the rice grains out to eat, and there's all this straw left, and it's good building material, especially for roofs. And in Europe, there's thatched roofs too, and I think they maybe more commonly might use wheat straw, so it doesn't matter. Various types of straw. This is my translation. I kind of based on Taigen Layton's translation. So there were various pieces when I looked at the Chinese, like I would change this and that, and eventually I just kind of made my own. I think his is called Song of the Grass Roof Hut or Hermitage. So. It's not like roofs are really made of grass exactly. I don't know what people would call that. It sounds funny to me. It would seem like it's like a green lawn. But the character does mean it's which translates grass, ordinary like lawn grass, and also thatch, which is like the dry straw. Some of you might have been to Tassajara, Zen Mountain Monastery, has the gate, the temple gate, has a thatched roof made by Paul Disco. It's very old style. It's very thick. With big gates and buildings like that, it can be like a foot or two thick. So it's like really waterproof. You wouldn't think grass or thatch would be so waterproof, but. But you do have to replace it. It doesn't last forever. And looking into it some, is it always just the roofs? And I found lots of images, even in Japan and China, I think, of like small huts where the walls are also thatched. So more commonly just to do the roof with thatch. But you could have an entire thatched hut. But So I was thinking it could be in this case. It doesn't say roof in the title. And the song begins, I've built a thatched hut. Here, hut or hermitage is, you know, a small dwelling, basically. You could translate it either way. It said hut throughout, but if you're announcing it as a title of a chant, it doesn't work well to have a T at the end. If it's the song of the thatched hut, but hermitage works better for chanting. I built a thatched hut with no treasures in it. So this poem is all about this hut. And usually these kind of poems, there's like a metaphor for something, right? So I really like, over the years, thinking of this poem, like, what is this hut metaphor pointing to, actually? It's not totally clear to me when you really go through the whole poem. So a few possibilities are that it's actually not a metaphor. It's just talking about his hut. He built this thatched hut and he's like celebrating it. There's one book commentary by Ben Connolly, has a book on this. And as I recall, I think he maybe explores different possibilities, but I think a lot of the book is interpreting it very literally, like it's not a metaphor. It's about simple living. The poem is kind of about simple living. So you could take it just that way. Living lightly on the earth, that kind of like building a thatched hut. But I think often these poems are more than that. He might have actually, Sekitoki said, I think did live out in the forest, a kind of a hermit, I think, for part of his life, as I recall. Forgot to check on that, but I think that's how it was. Later, he had a bigger temple and a larger sangha. But one of the things he was known for is sitting out in the forest on this large rock, because his name, Shirto or Sekito, means like stone and then kind of like head or top. So like you could translate his name Stonehead, but you could also say like on top of the stone, on top of the rock is Sekito. And as legend has it, there was this big rock, maybe like an outcrop with a nice view, and he sat zazen on this rock a lot. And I think you can still go to this place in China, Sekito's rock, where he sat. And then maybe later a temple developed there. So he's the kind of guy who would have actually maybe built a tiny thatched hut, as I think of him, because he lived out in the forest. So one possibility is that this poem's talking about just the, literally, a thatched hut. Another possibility is it's talking about the body. This body is like a thatched hut, and there's sometimes parts of the poem make it seem like that is maybe what he's talking about. Another possibility is talking about the mind is the hut, and what's inside. It's a lot about what's inside the hut and outside the hut and the person in the hut and so on. So it could be in the body, in the mind, another possibility is that the hut is zazen practice. So I'm just going to go with that one after I've contemplated all these versions of the hut. I've built a thatched hut with no treasures in it. That's why to interpret it as mind is a little funny, because you don't quite build the mind. If it's more like maybe our storehouse consciousness, with no special treasures in it, we kind of do build our storehouse consciousness out of our habitual patterns and so on, but I'm going to interpret it today, see how this works, as Zazen practice. So Zazen practice is something like, it's kind of given to us, we don't quite make it ourselves, and yet we do have to put some effort in. We can build a Zazen practice. In fact, today is a great opportunity to do so, because there's a lot of Zazen on the schedule. So you're welcome to build a thatched hut of Zazen by, for example, arranging your posture in an upright manner and sit in a relaxed way and let your breath sink down into the lower belly. You see, that's building the hut of Zazen. Some of the elements of building it. And then as we settle into this body and the breath as it is, we start to discover what's going on in Zazen. There's elements of Zazen that we don't build, that this poem explores too. But he starts off saying, I built a thatched hut with no treasures in it. I think it's a simple place. There's nothing special in here, and our Zazen can be like this too. Let's build a Zazen with no kind of fancy stuff going on in our Zazen. We don't need any fancy stuff. Just like a stable, relaxed, upright body and relaxed breath. We don't need any special treasures. Other than that, the next line is, after eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. So great. And if you take this in, it's a little bit, it's that one line kind of stands out a little bit unusual, the rest of the poem. But if we picture it in a kind of literal sense, this is his lifestyle in his mountain hut. If he bound together this thatch, built this hut, and then just like relax. Have a relaxed Zazen. There's nothing special in here. I don't need anything special. And my practice is not like, come on, I gotta like stay with it and like, come on, don't fall asleep. Concentrate, focus. It sounds like he's celebrating a way it's not like that, right? I built the hut. I'm a little tired now, so I'll boil some mountain potatoes. I eat a lot of those potatoes. I'll just like take a nap in the sun. And when I wake up, what should I do? Well, there's nothing really to do. I just sit in the hut. So of course, there's this feeling. A lot of these Chinese Zen poems have this kind of feeling of this like leisure kind of like relaxed life. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. You can, after lunch today, there's not that much time, but if you want to lie down in the sun and take a nap, you can. So then, now he goes back to the hut. One more point about the nap too, might say that if we're talking about Zazen here, after eating, I relax, enjoy a nap. It sounds so relaxed. So Zazen does take some diligence, but part of diligence is also relaxing, not letting diligence become stressful. So I think it's kind of some of that spirit of the relaxation side of Zazen. Now, after I built this hut, when I first built this hut of Zazen, probably all of you have sat Zazen before, right? Before today. And some of you maybe, when you first sat Zazen, it was a long time ago, and some it was more recent. But you can try to remember when you first built the hut of Zazen. When it was first built, the thatch was fresh. Like, we start with beginner's mind. So green and fresh, this thatch of Zazen. I remember when I, like, the first times I saw Zazen, actually. I was in college, and it was a Zen group, and they taught us how to sit, and I was amazed. It might have even been the very first time, but definitely the first few times, maybe the very first time, sitting for half an hour or something, and then they offered a few Dharma teachings, and then we'd go, and it was in some classroom at school, I think, and they walked out onto the green, and everything actually, this was one period of Zazen, everything looked fresh and alive and vibrant. It's not so much like that anymore after one period of Zazen, but I remember very early ones, maybe the first one, it was like that. When it was first built, my first period of Zazen, the fast was so fresh and green. But now, it's falling apart and needs to be rethatched. Isn't that how it is? It's hard to keep beginner's mind. As the more we practice Zazen, the more we lose that fresh beginner's mind, that initial inspiration. It's just like, yeah, I'm doing it because we're doing it. And I'm maybe like planning my day. Can check off my Zazen box. But it doesn't have the vibrancy as when it was first built. You might have that experience, right? So I think it's an encouragement. I have to keep refreshing it, which is like refreshing the beginner's mind. Take off the old rotting, molding thatch and put some new thatch in place. That's one way we might hear this. I think Taigen says when it was first built, weeds appeared and now it's covered with weeds or grass, something, which is sounds like if that's something different than the thatch, where it's the same word all the way through, right? It's the thatched hut, and the thatch was fresh and new, and now that it's been lived in or it's falling apart, more thatch, which in this case can be interpreted as it needs more thatch. We need to refresh our beginner's mind. We need to establish some continuity in our Zazen practice. Keep refreshing it again and again because it's constantly falling apart. The person abiding in the hut is always present. So now we have this relationship. There's something inside the hut, which is a lot of what this poem is about. The one in the hut. So we could say if it's just his Zazen hut, when he's in there, he's always present. But if it's the hut of Zazen that we're building with our posture and our breathing and our intentions and our refreshing of beginner's mind, there's somebody in the Zazen. Who is that? Oh, it's me, it's you. Well, who is that? Who's the one living in the Zazen? This present awareness, always present. So sometimes there's thoughts that are like thinking about other times and places. We sometimes call it distractions. These are thoughts that are rising and ceasing. But the person, the true one living in the hut, is always present, even when these thoughts of other times are rising and ceasing. There's someone who is always present in this Zazen hut, I would propose. I would understand Sekito to be pointing this out. Yeah. Always abiding. the abiding in the heart person is always abiding. Or, yeah, permanently. Because even it's the Chinese character they use for permanence. But this is just more like ever-present. Not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. So I think this is nice, right? It just says, it's the person who's abiding in the heart, this present awareness, is actually not inside the heart. If we look more carefully, this present awareness that's in our zazen, we find it in our zazen, it's not really inside of anything, or outside of anything, or, well, then if it's not inside or outside, it's maybe kind of in between, inside or outside. No. Why is this the case? Because the so-called person in the heart, which I would say is this ever-present ordinary awareness, is not located. And this theme comes up throughout the poem. It seems like a big theme for Shuto here. Later he's talking about it's not west or east or north or south. Here he's saying it's not inside, outside, or in between. So it's a nice point to consider, is that our zazen, for example, you could say, is on this cushion right here. Our zazen body and breath is happening in this particular location. But then this one who's inside the heart of zazen isn't really inside our body, isn't inside our posture, or outside the posture, or in between. In other words, this present ordinary awareness, very plain and ordinary. In other words, there's no special treasures here. It's just ordinary. This one has no location at all. You might feel like, well, my awareness is inside my body. I always thought it was, isn't it? So you're invited to explore deeply today. This was a nice point, I think, to explore. Is your present awareness, that's always present actually, even if you're distracted, just sense of being aware, is it located? Is it actually in the body or not? We know that we're aware, and we feel the sense of the body, and we can see the body. And we often might just assume that the awareness must be in the body. The body is like the given thing, and then awareness is kind of inside it and animating it. But I think if we examine our actual experience very closely, to me it seems like it's not really that way. It's more like the ever-present awareness is the given. That's always the case. And then what we call the body experientially is these sensations arising and ceasing. And also, if we look at it, it's sights arising and ceasing. But where are these sights of the body and these sensations of the body? In fact, that is what we call our body experientially, is sensations, tactile sensations, and visual imagery. And where is that body happening? Is it not happening in awareness? Are not these sensations that are arising and ceasing, the only way we know them as a body is because they're arising in our awareness. And the only way we can see this body is that the sight is actually appearing in awareness. Can you follow that? That, I think it might seem like, well, yeah, of course, it seems obvious. But in fact, I think many people, without examining that, feel it's the other way around, that the body, or that the awareness is actually arising in the body. And I would say if we examine our actual experience with, free of biases and so on, it seems like our body, as we know it through the senses, is appearing in awareness, kind of the reverse of our assumptions. Can you feel that like shift of perspective? We are aware, right? It's undeniable that we're aware. And then what we call the body, mostly for us throughout the day, what the body is experientially, is this field of tactile sensation. But if we happen to look at part of it or look at it in a mirror, then it's also a visual. And if we go like this, now the body is a sound called thud. So any way we can possibly experience a body is through the five senses. And even we might have conceptions of it too, like, I wish I had a nicer body, I don't like the body that I have because it's too this way or that way. Those are like conceptions of the body. So the five sensory experience of the body and even the concepts of the body, is it not the case that all six of these experiences of the body are happening in awareness? And awareness itself is, if it's not in the body, where is it? if we can come to the conclusion that awareness is not in the body because the body is actually in awareness. So where's awareness? I think that's what this line is about. The person abiding in the hut. When I hear the person in this poem, I'm interpreting it as, this is the awareness. And it seems to be happening in Zazen, the hut of Zazen. But it's actually this person, this awareness, is not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. In other words, it's totally unlocatable. And if you feel like awareness is located somewhere, you can deeply explore and see if you can find it there. So the poem goes on. Where worldly people abide, I don't abide. This is I. It's the character that's used for self, both for like small self and in the sometimes like the Buddha nature sutras, like this Parinirvana Sutra, that kind of radically in this old Indian sutra, it's all about Buddha nature and a disciple of the Buddha asked the Buddha, is there a self or not? I mean, there's all this teaching about, you say the body is not the self, the feelings are not the self, the dualistic perceptions are not the self. Or is there a self or not? And in the early teachings, the Buddha said, doesn't answer the question. But in this Nirvana Sutra, the Buddha kind of radically says, yes, but actually there is a true self. And it's called Buddha nature. So this is this first Indian sutra, and then later ones followed where they started using this term self, like true self, for Buddha nature. And when they translate that Indian sutra into Chinese, this is the character they use for that true self. But it's also used for small self. So you could, and I'm sure that Shurter know about this Nirvana Sutra, because it was very influential for early Zen in China. So you could say it's playing with this idea that where worldly people abide, the true self doesn't abide. You could read it that way. But you could also just say, I don't abide, in a more personal sense. where do worldly people abide? People of the world. Most of the world seems to be caught up in the past and the future, and putting the personal self foremost. Isn't that how the world, in its kind of like the way that things are not going so well in the world, is because worldly people abide in a kind of like self-centeredness, in the sense of small self. We could say where worldly people abide in their small self, I, the true self, don't abide. You could interpret it like that. Or you could say, I, Shoto, living in my Zazen hut, I don't abide in self-centeredness. and distraction, being pulled out of the present treasureless simplicity into complex distractions of other times and places. These days, it's often the phone. Worldly people abide in their phone. For a long time, I resisted having a cell phone. And at first, not many people had them. But even after, like, everyone seemed to have them, like, I just don't need it. I see how people relate to them. I just want to do without. The reason I ended up getting one is because I went to this Zen center. I went to live at Green Gulch Farm, and I was like, you know, helping the leadership of the Zen Center, like, okay, Coco, first thing is you have to get a cell phone, because we all communicate on the phone here at the Zen Center. Really? Like, yeah, you have to if you live here, if you're on the staff. We live here, but we actually just text each other all day. That's true. So, I went to the Zen Center, I had to get a phone. And I discovered, wow, this is amazing. I mean, they are amazing, right? Yeah. Everything. Flashlight. All the Dharma talks are on there. And email, Facebook, and phone, and text, and not to mention the World Wide Web. Everything. Maybe the poem is about the cell phone. Though it's small, the entire universe is in here. Anyway, I abide in the phone now. And one of my great Tibetan teachers is very kind of modernized Tibetan, but he's like, in his own teachings, really, you know, when they're translating a teaching, he'll pull out his phone and kind of check it. So he's really into his phone too. And but he said recently, I heard a talk where he's talking about retreat, and you know, people do like 3-month, 3-year retreat, and he's like, but these days, if you all want to do retreat, the best retreat is to spend 3 days without your phone.
Who said this?
This was Dzongchar Khyentse Rinpoche. He said, "If these days, if you can just put down your phone, you can interact with people as much as you want, but just don't touch your phone. If you can do that for 3 days, that's the equivalent of what used to be a 3-month retreat." And I thought, these days, it's too hard. I can't do it. I'll do a 3-month retreat, but I'm going to use my phone. Anyway. It's a challenge that I think Sekito Okizen didn't have. Worthy people abide in their phones, but I don't abide in mine. What worthy people love, I don't love. And you know, this character for love is kind of not the like meta love. This is the one that means more like a sort of kind of clingy love. So we might translate it as, usually translated as love, but it means like more worldly love. let's say, what worldly people are attached to, I'm not attached to. We could say he's praising himself, Sakitoki-sen, but we might just say the true self. What worldly people love, this true self doesn't love. We're talking about the one who's living in the hut, right? That's not stuck through inside, outside, or in between. It doesn't dwell anywhere. It's an unlocated true self. And that one doesn't abide in where worldly people abide or love what worldly people love. It's just present. You could say in this larger sense of love, which is just the sense of non-separation. It is like that, but worthy people loving the next model of iPhone or something. It doesn't care. It doesn't, there's no treasures in this hut. Though the hut is small, it includes the whole realm of reality, the Dharma Dhatu. So the hut, now, if the hut is zazen, then zazen can be kind of small. In other words, it's like, it's our, in a sense, it's our personal practice of zazen. But when we sit down and relax and sit upright and breathe in this, you know, intentional, personal practice kind of way, we start to discover the person in the hut. I'm proposing is more like this ever-present awareness that's not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. But the hut of zazen, you could say, is kind of small because it's like, it is kind of made out of this posture. So I think that's why I'm interpreting the hut here as zazen, that has this element where it's just like a posture and a breath and an intention. But then as we settle down, we start to discover the person in the hut. So the person in zazen is this really unlocated, boundless, spacious, and gracious awareness. So if you're like, well, I'm just arranging my body in zazen, it's like, it's kind of hard to sit still here, it's getting a little painful, this is all how zazen can feel kind of small sometimes. But actually, the more we're settled into it, even if it's not totally comfortable, we start to sense that within it is the whole Dharma Dhatu, the whole universe, the whole realm of reality. Dharma Dhatu is a very dynamic term because it can mean Dhatu is kind of like the field or space or element. Field or space is one connotation of Dhatu in Sanskrit. And then Dharma is like phenomena or Big D Dharma is kind of like reality. So it's been translated and interpreted over the many centuries and in different schools of Buddhism in different ways. So you could say the universe. Did Taigen's translation, does anyone remember, does it say the universe? I think it might say it includes the whole universe. I'm not sure about that. But so that is a valid understanding of Dharma Dhatu. It's like the entire realm of reality, but you could also say that it's the field of experience. All these dharmas are like moment-to-moment experiences, or the Tibetans often translate it as the basic space of all things, the basic space of phenomena, Dharma Dhatu, because Dhatu, when they translated Dhatu into Tibetan, they emphasized more the spacious quality. Yin in Tibetan is like space. So So it's the space, and it's the basic space, meaning it's like the, it's the space that is the basis for the whole world to appear. This is a very dynamic term, Dhammadhatu. In early Buddhism, and then Zen, and then Huayan, flower ornament school of Buddhism, they're really into this term, Dhammadhatu. They have four Dhammadhatus. Like, but that's a lot of fancy treasures. In this case, it's just the Zazen hut is small, but it includes everything. Basically, it includes all space. It includes all, the whole realm of reality. In this 10-foot square, an old person illuminates appearances and their nature. So 10-foot square seems to refer to Vimalakirti's house. So this is Vimalakirti Sutra, where Vimalakirti is he's a kind of wealthy householder in India, but he actually lives in a kind of a small house. It's like 10 square feet, we often translate it, but that, you know, strictly speaking, 10 square feet would mean like it's 5 foot by 2 foot. That was 10 square feet, right? So I think maybe better to say 10 foot square. In other words, it's 10 feet on each side in Chinese, it means like that. And so Vimalakirti had this room, and he invited like all these, he was going to give some teaching, and invited in all these bodhisattvas, like innumerable thousands of bodhisattvas. And they're all like, well, how are we going to fit in your 10-foot square room, Vimalakirti? And he's like, well, just come on in, you'll fit. And they did. So then later, people loved that image, I think. So then they started calling the abbot's quarters in the Zen temples, they called them the 10-foot square, in Japanese, Hojo. That's what this poem says. The Hojo literally means the 10-foot square. And then they started calling the abbots Hojo-san. Really. Hey, 10 square foot. 10-foot square literally is what it means. But it's referring to their room. Why? Because maybe it's actually based on this poem. Of course, this poem, I think, is referring to the Vimalakirti Sutra. But this is like one of the first Zen poems. And what happens in the abbot's room? An old guy, a roshi, is like an old guy. Old teacher. An old person, in this case, Rojin. In the 10 square foot, an old person illuminates appearances and their nature. That's what hopefully the abbots are doing in their quarters, whenever they're in there. Of course, they might, their tasks are many, so they might get distracted sometimes. Well, what's that?
They might take a nap.
They might, after eating, take a nap. Yes, yes, yes. Definitely. They're allowed to. And but in this 10-foot square, I think he's referring to his hut here. So it's, you know, whether it's the literal thatched hut or whether it's Zazen, in this particular body and mind of Zazen that has this particular dimensions and so on, in this Zazen hut, an old person illuminates appearances and their nature. That's one way to translate it. So, illuminates means like explores and investigates and looks around. So, in this hut of Zazen, we're invited today to look around that hut, like illuminate the space inside the hut here with our mind and the flashlight of our mind. Illuminate, what do we illuminate? First, I would say, then actually the nature of the space in the hut. we're sitting in Zazen, and we're looking, what's the person in the hut? It's this ever-present awareness. That's our true nature. Well, how do we illuminate it? We'll just see if we notice it. And I think one way to make it practical, like, well, how do we get at it? We can't see it, this awareness. I agree, we can't see it. We see all the stuff that it illuminates. But how do we illuminate the awareness itself, the person in the hut? My favorite method, some of you know, is to just ask ourself while sitting as Zazen, is awareness present? Could even ask it right now. Am I aware right now? Is awareness present? Is there some experiencing? These are all versions of the same question. Am I experiencing anything? And as soon as we ask and look, illuminate, we find, well, yeah, of course. How could it not be? If I'm alive, I'm experiencing. There is awareness. And if we ask, well, what is it? Well, I'm not so sure what it is, actually, because I can't see it or get a hold of it. But I do know that I'm aware. And if I don't, if I'm not sure if I'm aware, this is why this simple question, very simple question, you can ask, am I aware? Is awareness present? Again, by awareness here, I don't mean like, am I concentrated and focused? It doesn't matter in this case. If we're focused and concentrated, or we could be very distracted and then ask this question, is awareness present? I would say, yeah, it is present, and it's exactly the same as if I was very clear, deep in samadhi. That kind of awareness is the same one. The awareness that's present when I'm deep in samadhi is the same awareness that's present when I'm totally scattered and distracted. This is the awareness that I'm most interested in. The one that's ever present, always present, and doesn't change. So we can ask this question, whatever state of mind we're in, however our zazen is going, we can ask, if we remember, is awareness present? We can just stop and check. In other words, this practice is kind of implying that when we're asking if awareness is present, it doesn't matter what state of mind you're in. It's going straight to the fact of being aware. But in fact, if you ask it sincerely, even when you're distracted, in order to answer the question, if you're aware or not, you have to kind of like come into the present a little bit just to answer the question, right? So, well, yeah, I'm all distracted, but I do see that there's an awareness of the distraction. I know that there is an awareness of the distraction, and already our zazen is different. You can try it out and see. You don't have to eliminate any distraction in order to answer the question, but you have to, you know, a little bit, just like, pay a little bit less attention to the content of the distraction in order to answer the question. Is awareness present? You don't have to eliminate anything, but you're trying to answer, am I aware? And we're always aware, so the answer will always be yes. But asking it is a practice. So in this 10-foot square Zazen hut, it includes the whole realm. Oh, an old person illuminates appearances and their nature. So this is awareness present, I would say, is illuminating the nature, that nature, like the Buddha nature, our self nature, our true nature, our own nature, is this way that the Zen people talk about who we really are. So who we really are is this awareness, because it's always present. We can illuminate that by asking, is awareness present? And it can also illuminate appearances, especially first, I would propose first illuminating, just, is awareness present? Yes. Well, then what's all these thoughts and stuff going on? Well, that's what we call the appearances. What about these painful legs? That's the appearances. And now we can explore, you know, we're both at the same time. There is an awareness, and then there's these sensations happening in awareness. And these thoughts, we call distractions, are arising and ceasing in the space, the spacious, gracious awareness. It's spacious because it's not located inside, outside, or in between. It's not anywhere. It's like space isn't anywhere. And it's gracious because it's just so allowing. Gracious means like it's a good host. Maybe he's Shripta's going to call it the host. It's a, like Jim and Karen are such gracious hosts. I stayed with them last night. They remind me of Buddha nature because Buddha nature is very gracious. It's just like, well, you want something to eat or drink or place to sleep or is it more hot, more cool, like anything is allowed. I didn't say, can I like, you know, throw dirt all over your house or something? But they're so gracious that they probably said, well, if you really want to. They didn't forbid me to do anything. Anyway, awareness is like this. It's like so gracious. It allows everything, basically. It allows every experience. And if we're not sure if that's the case, just check out your own awareness. And that's the proof. Because you've had every type of experience, and super painful experiences, super angry, klesha experiences, super distracted, super dull, just sleeping, awake, eating, everything. All of that, all those experiences, every experience you've ever had, was allowed to happen, wasn't it? If it wasn't allowed, it wouldn't have happened. So even the ones we think, these are really horrific experiences I've had and totally deluded and self-centered, all of that is allowed. And you and I are the living proof of that. Because we've had all these experiences. And, you know, what allows them? The host, the gracious host of this ordinary awareness. It's proven that it allows everything because everything that's happened has happened where? In awareness, hasn't it? So it's very gracious in that way. That's kind of its compassion. It's natural. It's open. Our just ordinary awareness is open to everything. And we are the living proof of it. You can illuminate these points in Zazen like this old person does. Your nature is the space, and then all the experiences within them are what I would call the appearances. They're not really real, they're just stuff appearing in the space of awareness. In your nature, the appearances are happening in our nature. These are just different words for these two dimensions, you could say, of experience. One is just the space of awareness that we can't find or get a hold of it, but it's always present. Whenever we ask if it's here, we have to say yes. We can't say, if you say no, no awareness is not present, or I'm not even sure if it's present. Sometimes people say, well, I'm not sure awareness is present. If we're clear on what we mean by awareness, it's just that which allows everything. So if you're having the thought, not sure, awareness must be there. Because you can't have the thought, not sure, without awareness. The thought, I'm not sure awareness is present, where is it happening? It's happening in awareness, right? So we get more and more used to this. This is an experiential thing, too. This is not like philosophy, really. I hope you can approach this kind of thing if it's new to you. My favorite way of approaching it's a little bit weird. You don't really find it in the Zen poems, but I really like it's a method. You could say it's a Zazen method. It's a layer of thatch that when my Zazen hut got really worn out, I rethatched it with this question. And it's been staying fresh for a while now. The question is awareness present? That is, to ask it really sincerely, experientially, is a way to illuminate our nature. And then we can illuminate the stuff, the appearances in it. A bodhisattva of the unsurpassed vehicle trusts without doubt. You might say, is that the Mahayana, the great vehicle? But there's other ways of translating, standard ways of saying great vehicle. This is the unsurpassed vehicle. So you could say it goes beyond the great vehicle. You might say, vehicles are like practice paths, you might say. Understandings and methods and so on are the vehicles, the yanas of Buddhism. So the unsurpassed vehicle could be interpreted as Zen, this radical Zen hut dwelling is like this, the unsurpassed vehicle or the supreme vehicle. And a bodhisattva of this Zen vehicle trusts without doubt. Sort of like redundant, because that's what trust means, is like not doubting. And doubting means not trusting. So, trust what? Any guesses? What's most important to trust, do you think, for Sekitoki-san? Yeah, I think so. Trust that this awareness is present. It's so ordinary. It's like, well, that's easy to trust. So what? But really illuminate the implications of this. I trust, basically, that this one in the hut who doesn't dwell inside, outside, or in between, that I take refuge in that. And we can call it Buddha nature. Or we could call it Buddha, actually. And that's, we can trust it, take refuge in it. And in the unsurpassed vehicle, that's the bodhisattvas, they have no doubt. But I'm not sure if I'm aware. I know, they know. They're aware, but they know more than that, too. They know that this, as the poem is going to go on, there's some big implications that Sekido has reveals here. Those of middle or low capacities, this would be like on the lesser vehicles, we might say, they can't help wondering if this hut will be destroyed or not. So if we're staying with the metaphor of the hut is actually not the awareness, right? The hut is Zazen here. But can I maintain the Zazen practice where I discover the hut? Maybe even in the lesser vehicles, those are middle or low capacities. They have some doubts, like, I can find the stillness and presence in Zazen. I don't know if I can maintain the Zazen all the time. Especially like as I'm getting older and the hut, the thatch is all like rotting and falling apart, and I can't find any more fresh thatch. How am I going to maintain this my presence of Zazen? Some might start wondering that, but these unsurpassed vehicle bodhisattvas don't have that doubt. Why? Because they trust the person in the hut. The hut might fall apart, but the person in the hut every time we ask, is awareness present? Here it is, right? So whether it's destroyed or not, so he leaves some room there, right? Those who are middle or lower capacities can't help wondering if this hut will be destroyed or not. Can I always sustain zazen? And what about at the time of my death? At some point, I'm going to have to, like, this body is going to go. Then what happens to my zazen? I mean, even those of middle capacity might have doubts like that. But the unsurpassed vehicle bodhisattvas, I don't even need this posture. I don't even need this body. Because I'm going to lose it at some point anyway. So that's, you know, some of them might have that trust even. But those of middle or low capacity can't help wondering if this hut of zazen will be destroyed or not. Whether it's destroyed or not, Sekido says. He's not like, no, you're zazen, you can always maintain it. He leaves some room. He's like, well, it might be destroyed. That's what it sounds like to me. Whether it's destroyed or not, that's not the point, I think he's saying. Because the host originally abides. That's why it's okay. Even if the hut of zazen is destroyed and the thatch burns to the ground, the host originally abides, kind of Zen talk, right? Originally abides means like timeless, like the host has always been here. Maybe before the hut was built, the host was here, and then the hut was built kind of around the host. Okay. So the awareness is always present, and then at some point before we were born, before our parents were born. And then at some point, somebody says, you want to sit zazen? Well, arrange your legs like this and let your breath settle down and relax. Sit upright. That's kind of like building the hut around the person, around the host. The host is already here, and then we can build zazen, what we call zazen, around it. But the host was originally abiding. And always abides, timelessly, beginninglessly, and endlessly, because the host is timeless. The host is not like moving through time. And as we heard earlier, the host, I would say the host and the person in this poem are the same. The person is not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. So this host is timeless, and it's dimensionless, locationless, both are being brought up here, it sounds like, here, there, the way this guy is interpreting it. Whether it's destroyed or not, the host originally abides, originally meaning like beginninglessly, timelessly, not dwelling south or north, east or west. So there it is. The host is timeless and the host is locationless. In two lines. Whether the hut's destroyed or not. So then we might start to reify the host into like, well, it's some kind of like indestructible essence, some kind of like thing here that we like got, and a soul, our true self is the size of our thumb dwelling in our heart organ. Some Indian traditions talk that way. You can't find it if you dissect the body, but it's like a kind of a located true self. But this one's Buddha nature is, it can't be found or located anywhere. And that's why it can't be destroyed. When the hut is destroyed. When the whole universe is destroyed. Is this destroyed? Whether the hut's destroyed or not, the host originally abides, not dwelling south or north, east or west. So That's about halfway. You can stick around this afternoon if you want to hear the clincher. Punchline. It's more of the same, really, but it's good. I really like this poem. Personally, I think it's, I may be in my preferential small mind, I maybe like it even more than the harmony of difference and equality. It's more interesting. It's more visual. It's more playful. I think harmony of difference and equality is more philosophical, actually, about the relationship of difference and unity. It's also a beautiful poem. And this is also, you could say, brings up difference in unity and their harmony. I would say the line that comes to mind right now is in this 10-foot square of Zazen, an old person illuminates appearances and their nature. You could say appearances is the realm of difference, and our true nature is the realm of equality. And the Bodhisattva is illuminating both simultaneously, and the relationship between them, which is a harmonious relationship. So we're already over time, but do you have any questions, especially about how to, we're kind of unpacking a poem, but how we might practice, what's the heart of the practice in this poem? Yes.
I'm not sure what the question is, but I recall this phrase, not here or not there or in between, in I think it's Buddha's teaching to Bahai Bahia.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And maybe Sikto Kisan was thinking about that, or maybe not.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, that early teaching of the Buddha, where in what you're seeing, it will be just the seen, and what you're hearing, it will be just the heard. And when it's like that for you, then there's no you in addition to the seen and the heard. And when there's no you, as I recall the Buddha says, when there's no you, there's no here or there or in between. And in that case, we might take it as there's no, like, me over here hearing, there's no sound over there being heard, and there's nothing in between either. So, which is a kind of like inside outside, or in between.
So because the perception is indistinguishable from the thing perceived.
That's right. Yeah.
And the perceiver.
Yeah, yeah. We often feel like our awareness is the perceiver. And we feel sometimes like it might be located in our body or in our head over here on this side, and that which we're aware of is out there. That's a common human perception, I think. But as we explore this more, first exploring what is awareness present, and then where is it? Does it have any edges? Does it have any center or location? We eventually may come to conclude, no, it's really not located anywhere. That was sort of a projection to say that it dwells anywhere. So it's not a subject. This awareness is not a subject over here, observing the world over there. It is, it includes the entire realm of reality. It is unlocated. It's actually subjective or objective. It's doesn't fit into those categories. Even though the poem is sometimes is kind of saying, is taking, the way I'm interpreting it, is taking the slant of the person's dwelling in the hut. It sounds like awareness is dwelling in Zazen. That's why I wouldn't want to say it's dwelling in the body, because we often perceive that way, and then it takes us down some dead-end alleys. But if we say Zazen, awareness is dwelling in Zazen. Zazen is kind of hard to define because it has this element of like it has a body and a breath, but also Zazen is the spaciousness of sitting, or you might even say at some point it might even be like samadhi, is this the kind of like spacious presence in Zazen. And then you could say the heart of that samadhi is actually just awareness that was always present. It's not really different than it. So this is just Kokyo, it's maybe clunky interpretation of the poem, but, and then poems also have their limitations because it's all about a hut, so we have to stay with the hut imagery and the thatch imagery. Yes.
So I think I heard you say So first of all, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I did hear you correctly, if you could explain more, but I think you said that awareness doesn't change.
Yeah.
And what do you mean by that? Because it strikes me in the gut when I think of the Heart Sutra and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a controversial one, I agree. And when the Nirvana Sutra in ancient India is talking about Buddha nature, it makes this point over and over again. It's like a central point that they don't want to miss, is that Buddha nature is permanent and indestructible and unchanging. So, and I think they knew that that was a little bit radical to talk that way. This is like the 3rd century in India. They knew the teaching of no self, the teaching of impermanence. And in fact, this Nirvana Sutra teaches all that stuff too. So it's saying the Buddha's teaching it probably is a Mahayana Sutra. But the Buddha is saying, I teach that all conditioned experiences, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. They don't last even a moment. And they're unsatisfying ultimately. They're dukkha, right? And they're not myself. And then this sutra is the beginning of this kind of controversial thing. And this sutra is the first place to say, now I'm teaching this new thing called Buddha nature. And the sutra itself even uses terms like the secret treasury. It's almost like an esoteric new teaching. The sutra is kind of self-consciously talks that way. Like, we know this is a radical thing to say. And it's not denying that. It's saying Buddha nature is not one of those conditioned phenomena. Because those are all impermanent. And they're not self. And they're dissatisfying. And they're impure. The Buddha taught that over and over. And the Buddha in this sutra also teaches that. Now I teach this Buddha nature. It's not a conditioned experience. It's not a sin. It's totally ungraspable. And therefore, the sutra says it's the opposite of those 4 early things. It's, instead of impermanent, it's ever-present. You could say it's nitya. It's the opposite of anicca. It's permanent. It's instead of saying it's not self, the sutra says it's atman. So crazy for the Buddhists to talk this way, right? I call it the Atman. His disciples say, is there an Atman or not? And in this sutra, the Buddha says, there is an Atman. It's called Buddha nature, Buddha Dhatu. All conditioned things are impure. Buddha nature, in this case, is pure. And all conditioned things are ultimately dissatisfying. Buddha nature is bliss. It's ultimately satisfying. So then naturally these questions arise. How can you say anything's permanent? We just have to make sure to understand that it's not a thing. It's not a thing. And the sutra even has all these synonyms for Buddha nature, like emptiness. And I think even Prajnaparamita would say, all conditioned things are arising and ceasing, but emptiness itself is the ultimate truth. Emptiness doesn't arise and cease. because it's not a thing that could arise and cease. It's not conditioned. And even our dear Heart Sutra, I think these are the most underrated lines in the Heart Sutra. The sutra says, all dharmas are marked by emptiness, or we could translate it. All conditioned phenomena have the characteristic of emptiness. And then from that perspective, they see all these things. They don't arise and cease. Have you noticed that in the sutra? From the perspective of emptiness, things don't arise and cease. Arising and ceasing is what's called impermanence. So, from the perspective of emptiness, things don't arise and cease, so they're not impermanent. They don't arise in the first place, and therefore they can't cease. So from, even in the Heart Sutra, from that ultimate perspective, things, appearances, actually don't arise and cease, and they're not pure and impure, and they don't, and so on. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So, this Buddha nature is kind of like that. It's from the perspective of Buddha nature. Buddha nature itself doesn't arise and cease, so it's not an impermanent thing. I would agree that to call it permanent is maybe too loaded a term because then we think of it as a permanent thing, like an entity or a soul or something. But the sutra, I think, does use that term nitya, and it also uses this term indestructible, like vajra in Sanskrit means indestructible. But it's a little bit, you could say, almost like a little bit, there's a gleam in Buddha's eye, maybe when he talks that way, because indestructible means only things that have been produced can be destroyed, and Buddha nature is not that kind of thing. So it's not like it's kryptonite, some indestructible substance. It's just that it's indestructible because it's not a thing that could be destroyed. So it's a subtle point, but thank you for bringing it up, because many people, even after many discussions around this with people, I still just, I can't put that word permanence into my mouth. It's too heretical as a Buddhist to use that word. Many people feel this way. And the sutra never got that popular in India, as I understand. It's this massive, like, 1,000-page sutra, mostly about Buddha nature. But it got translated into Chinese maybe a century or two after it appeared in India. And China, they loved it. And I think it's maybe because they didn't have all the Indian background of Buddhism in China, that it was like Mahayana was like the first thing that came to China. Anyway, that's a long-winded response, but yeah. Thank you. It's about time to stop, but how about come one last? I'll try to keep it short.
I have a relatively simple question. Does awareness necessarily involve or generate an object of mind?
That's a simple question. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. That's a great question. Does awareness necessarily generate an object of mind? So, of course, Kokyo could take that ball and go running for the rest of the day. calm down, Kokyo. So awareness is like this big, gracious, spacious host that's not divided into subject and object. That's an important point about this, what we can call the Buddha nature. And it's very ordinary. The Zen people emphasize how it's not this special hidden thing. It's just our ordinary awareness is actually like that, but our ordinary non-dual Buddha awareness, for basically everybody, for all sentient beings, it does these tricks, and its main trick is to seemingly divide itself into, split itself. It doesn't really, it can't split itself. Buddha reality, undivided reality, can't be split, but it does this trick. It seems to split itself to our perception and to the sense of a subject over here, like a mind over here, a personal mind over here, and then the objects over there, like the colors and the sounds, outside of itself. It seems to project not only, well, it does both at once. It projects an outside world of experience at the same time as it projects an inside perceiver. And that's called dualistic consciousness. In Sanskrit, vijnana is the fifth aggregate. And so, by the way, that consciousness is impermanent, the Buddha teaches in all these sutras. So this is not dualistic consciousness we're talking about. It's unchanging. It's before it's divided, before vijnana is divided, it's just jnana. It's non-dual knowing. And so your question was like, does awareness generate itself as an object? I would say, is that your question?
Well, I'm asking it mainly because as I get older, I find that my recollection of objects of mind is very fleeting.
It doesn't matter so much, really, in the long run, I would say.
Oh, you think not?
It doesn't matter as much, I would say, as the fact of just exploring how the way that this undivided awareness generates objects is it has to generate a subject at the same time. Basically, it seems to divide itself into a subject and an object. And yeah, I like your language. It generates, awareness generates the world of objects by simultaneously generating itself as a subject. And then that's what we call delusion, but also we call it just ordinary human perception, as we all like go through the world this way. And then, well, how can we find this non-dual awareness? And that's what this beauty of these Buddha nature teachings are saying. We already have it. This is already it. It's just the mind is doing this trick, and it's always been doing this trick. And now we have these teachings about this kind of subtle practice of not tricking ourselves anymore. And then, yes, as we get older, the subjective mind isn't working so well, the objective world isn't appearing so well, but that's all going to fall apart at the end, and the hut's going to perish. So before it does, can we illuminate the appearances and the nature, the person in the hut, before it's too late? Of course, we'll have many more chances, because this has been going on beginninglessly. But in this, we might not discover Zen in our next life so quickly. So we've gotten this far. Wow. We might not have had this chance for like eons. So here it is. We'll finish it later today. Thank you very much.